So I'm ending up doing a speaking tour of the United States, talking about anarchism in Ireland, and while doing it, it struck me that the big story back in Ireland about the United States is, of course, the elections. And because I'm doing this speaking tour, I'm meeting a lot of Americans who would have another perspective and perhaps finding out about another America than that's covered in the news. The first stop on my tour is Providence, Rhode Island, which is near Boston, basically, if you're trying to locate it. It's a city of just over 100,000 people, and in fact was originally founded by religious exiles. While in Providence, I talked to Xenia and Mark, who were involved in SDS, that's Students for a Democratic Society, an organization that existed in the 60s and has been revitalized in the last couple of years, or reformed, and they're also involved in the Industrial Workers of the World. While there, I also took part in the SDS protest at Brown University. So, I'm in Providence, Rhode Island, and doing an interview. We're going to talk about Students for Democratic Society and maybe some of the other, maybe some anarchist-related stuff that's happening here as well. So, if you do want to introduce yourselves.
Well, my name is Mark Bray, and I'm from Providence, Rhode Island, and in addition to doing SDS, I'm also a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Union. Organizationally, that's, I guess, my main organization, but I've done other sorts of political and activist work in addition.
My name is Xenia. I am an organizer with the new SDS as well, as well with the IWW, and I've been primarily involved in doing student debt activism on campus and Colombian human rights activism more recently.
Okay, so maybe if we start about talking about SDS, and we might go on to talk about some local stuff later, but I know very little about it. I mean, I've heard of the original Students for Democratic Society, and I remember seeing about 2 years ago, you know, various online announcements that it was being set up, and kind of going, kind of interesting, I wonder, you know, what the point of that is. But from what people have been telling me, it's actually been pretty successful. Do you want to sort of give it maybe a brief history of its recent emergence and how that happened?
Sure. Well, 2 years ago on Martin Luther King Day, two students from Stonington High School in Connecticut in the States, Pat Corte and Jessica Rapchick, were pretty disillusioned with organizing with an organization called World Can't Wait, which is a big anti-war coalition in the States. And so they wanted to do activism that wasn't linked to the groups that are organizing now in the movement, not with United with Peace and Justice. They wanted to have something that's their own. And
with a lot of groups like that, there's a tendency to feel either like they're disproportionately controlled by sectarian, authoritarian leftist communist groups, or just simply there was an interest in getting around the issue of the organization being run by older people and having young people and students sort of following their orders. So to create more of an autonomous, non-sectarian, leftist student youth and an organization like that that could be our own.
Right. So Jessica and Pat reformed the Students for a Democratic Society with the help of older generation SDSers. And started out slowly, largely on high school campuses and community colleges and state colleges, also at elite colleges like Brown, which I go to.
And the name brand recognition aspect helped it grow very quickly in a very short amount of time. I graduated from my undergraduate university education before SDS started, but it would have been nice to have an easy way to link up my campus organization with a national network. And I think there were one or two other networks that were attempted previously. One was called CAN, Campus
Anti-War Network.
Anti-War Network, and there are a couple other ones.
That one had, sketchy,
supposedly some politically questionable aspects.
Well,
but
I think
know.
A lot of people were linked to, some of the, RCP groups and stuff.
Revolutionary Communist Party, for those listening at home. And so I think it grew rather quickly because then people could tap into it. And people were interested in the tradition of the organization, and I think considering that there was such a parallel in American society between the Iraq War and the Vietnam War that it just felt right to sort of do the same kind of anti-war activism, because that has been the main emphasis of SDS for most chapters, I would say, would be anti-war.
How many chapters are we talking about? How widespread is it? I'm really unsure of that myself.
The number keeps getting updated. I'd say...
I heard.
Go ahead.
400.
Like 400 chapters or something like that, mostly in the United States, but I think that there's a few in Canada and maybe one or two here or there, even in Europe, apparently, but I've only heard that from word of mouth. It's pretty large and pretty significant.
And then what sort of coordination is there between individual chapters, and how does that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, when it started out, there was a question of how it would be organized on a national level, and there was a desire on most people's parts to have it be more than the fact that there are a bunch of little organizations with the same name. You know, we want it to be an organization, not just a network.
And a movement,
yeah. So, well, we had the national convention, and we talked about different organizational structures and ways to make it so that autonomy would be preserved at the local level, but that it would be an organization and not just a network. And there are various proposals thrown out, and the one that was chosen was a federated structure where the majority of the control would be in the chapter, considering that most people spend most of their actual organizing time with their local fellow organizers, but that there would be initiatives both regionally and nationally to pursue and common projects so that there would be a sense of cohesion. But of course, the internet has played a large role in actually facilitating coordination. There are various listservs, and we, for example, have gotten to know a lot of people around the Northeast and elsewhere simply through email and through the various regional and national meetings.
And I mean, it's called Students for Democratic Society, so there's students, kind of high school students and college students.
Yeah, it's actually one of the...
An interesting question that you point out, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the debates that was going on in the National Convention. Some folks wanted to do away with the... essentially, we were trying to define what it meant to be a member of Students for Democratic Society. Some people said, well, you have to be a student, because it's Students for Democratic Society. Some people wanted to say, well, no, you have to be a young person. And so I think there wasn't a decision made because, you know, it just would not be democratic if we, the select few who are at the convention, made decisions for the whole nation. So I think what was passed down as, like, a recommendation of, like, a good definition for a member of SDS.
The idea was to sort of try and balance both considerations. So either a student at some sort of an institution, or a person 30 years old or younger. So that way, graduate students older than 30 would be in, but young people that were not out of school would be in. And there are some older people who were either in the original SDS or were a little too young at the time but wish they had been in the original SDS, which maybe is even more problematic, who wanted to be in the new SDS. But as I mentioned previously, one of the goals of the new SDS was to have something that was really run by young people and a place for youth autonomous space. So that was a way to balance both considerations. But some of those older people have been pushing to have basically no restrictions, or just have anyone be part of it. But I think part of the strength of the idea of SDS is that different segments of society and different types of people should be organizing themselves along issues that matter to them personally. Okay. So it wouldn't make sense for everyone in a given city necessarily to spend a lot of their time on educational debt reduction or tuition freezes or something like it, you know, that's a student issue. So that was the sort of compromise solution.
You mentioned conferences. So there's been meetups. Has that been from everybody who's involved? Or are they more regional, or how's that worked?
Well, there's supposed to be a national conference every year, and it rotates. Usually, it's located like in the middle of the United States.
Well, only two have occurred.
Right, well, it's going to happen. It's supposed to happen yearly.
Yeah.
It usually happens, like, in Chicago or Detroit, so people can meet halfway.
Yeah, the first one was Chicago, the second one was Detroit. Have they set a location for the
second
one?
I don't know. Okay. And then there's regional conferences. Like, for example, we're having a New England regional conference this weekend, and there's a Northeast conference. And then some states have conferences, like Virginia has its own conference because they have enough members. New York City has, like, their own, I guess, like...
Yeah, part of the idea with SDS is to have organizations both based in specific schools or universities, and geographic areas. So in Providence, there's, you know, Brown SDS, and then there are students that are at other schools like Providence College and Rhode Island School of Design. But so, you know, for example, Brown SDS will do their own thing that's very Brown specific, and then they'll meet up with other students in the city to do Providence SDS. So for example, New York, which is one of the most active cities for this, they'll have New York SDS meetings and New York SDS projects, and then they'll have campus-specific stuff.
And one of the things I've noticed in relation to it is a lot of debate around the setting up of caucuses for different groups within SDS. Do you want to sort of give us details of that?
Sure. I mean, I think it was actually one of the really refreshing aspects of the new SDS is that people are aware of, in a real way, of the way that oppressions intersect, and like the ways that everyone, in a certain sense, has to be responsible of being aware of inequalities even amongst our comrades. So there are several caucuses that are built up to more or less keep an eye out on those dynamics. So there's a women's caucus, transgender caucus, queer caucus, a people of color caucus, and a high school caucus, because there isn't a lot of young people, like high schoolers in the National SDS, largely like college students. So.
And the counterpart to those is the privileged working groups. So, like for example, at the convention, when one of the caucuses would meet, like for example, the people of color caucus, then there was a white privilege meeting group to discuss ways to address our own potentially subtle prejudicial behavior, and to think of ways that it's not just, for example, in this case, people of color, it's not up to them to always be the ones calling out white people, but it's up to white people in addition to be self-reflective and to keep an eye on their own behavior. So it's both of those things. And also, I think it's in part based on a recognition that these problems were prevalent in the original SDS and were not regarded in a sufficient degree. And so, at the very least, within our organizations, we'll make it as best an effort to treat each other appropriately.
One of the slogans, one of the buttons from period, from an SDS button at the time was, girls say yes to guys who say no. And so I think that is indicative of the sexist sort of dynamics, which are very prevalent in that period. Pretty wild.
I don't know personally a whole lot about the history of SDS, and I don't know enough to really comment in specific on that, but from what I heard, it was an issue. And even if you put SDS aside, I think it's been an unstated issue in a lot of leftist groups historically, and I think it's important to recognize non-class oppressions, because in some cases they haven't been recognized. Unfortunately, in some cases it's pushed to the point where class oppressions are not recognized sufficiently.
There is a working class caucus.
Right, but like even in SDS, from what I've heard in some chapters, there have been debates over whether to be explicitly against capitalism, for example, and even on the part of people who are anti-capitalist, discussing whether the role of SDS is to be so radical that it might potentially turn off liberals, for example, because I think one of the benefits of the group is taking people that are politically moderate and moving them in a more radical direction. So the question is, how radical should the stance be? The concern being that you may not be able to do that quite as much. There's debate about it, but at the convention, at least, the prevailing sentiment was to be explicitly anti-capitalist, as the original SDS was, and to push more of an explicit radical and, to a large extent, anti-authoritarian stance.
Yeah, in terms, we didn't actually talk about it, probably should have at the beginning, but in terms of aims, is there a simplified set of agreed aims for SDS? Or
the main thing is participatory democracy, which is a bit of a vague term, in large part intentionally so. My understanding of the original use of the term in SDS has a lot to do with coming up with language that would be acceptable to both authoritarian and anti-authoritarian socialists in the late 60s. And so it's not direct democracy. It's not democratic centralism. It's participatory democracy, which I guess is something in between direct democracy and representative democracy.
And actually, one of our points of unity has direct democracy as part of it. So, I mean, I know at my school we voted in favor of it.
So. Yeah, ironically, you'll be in a position where people that might describe themselves as liberal get in the group and get in the sort of hegemony of an anti-authoritarian, directly democratic ideology, and I think its merits speak for themselves to the point where they're voting for these various issues and come out in favor of anti-capitalist platforms, but maybe previously wouldn't describe themselves as that. But if I'm not entirely mistaken, I think participatory democracy is the more commonly used expression.
Yeah.
And I guess the point I was just trying to get to is it means different things to different people,
mm-hmm.
and has historically had maybe a hazy meaning, at least for SDS.
Mm-hmm.
And it is indicative of the intent of SDS being a compromise between different ideologies.
Yeah.
And so in terms of, say, SDS activity here in Providence, I mean, regular meetings, protests, what exactly is the sort of stuff that's going on?
Well, at least at Brown, largely I've done anti-war organizing, like 2 years, maybe a year and a half ago, we did a big demonstration. And by big, I mean that, like, newspapers pay attention, which is, you know...
Not always a given.
Yeah. a big demonstration against Textron, which is a weapons manufacturer who has its now international headquarters in Providence. Yeah, and so that was pretty good. I mean, in terms of, like, I think they mentioned it in, like, the MSNBC national TV about how, like, because one of our members was arrested. It's really shady, and he eventually got...
His charges were dropped.
And, yeah, it was just a really good linked up with anti-war groups in Providence and community groups, and it was a good experience. More recently, we've been working on student debt and making a fair and accessible education at Brown. And in Providence, we're working on the March 20th anti-war, you know, week of action.
A worthwhile project worth mentioning for Brown SDS is the student union.
Oh, right.
Which is encouraging... Well, for several reasons. One, because it's good, I think, for students to organize themselves as students as much as possible. I think far too often students in the United States will look elsewhere for issues to get involved with where there are many important ones for them to get involved with that are not only limited in their scope to things affecting students, but to the greater society. Accessible education affects all facets of society. And so at Brown, they're forming one of the first... legitimate student
the
unions.
First private school, I mean, I say that in quotations, student union, and that's pretty exciting.
In quotations because they receive a lot of public funding.
Yeah, well, it's largely, this notion of private-public dichotomy is really quite crass, because a lot of students, especially working class students, get, like, you know, loans from and grants from the government, and that's how, like, they pay their tuition.
And on the other side, a lot of public institutions receive a lot of private funding.
Right, and so largely, yeah, like we've had general assemblies, we've had how many? I think like 4 already. Our next one's coming up in March of 2008. And like for example, at the last one, we there's a university financial board on our campus. And they have closed-door meetings. In order for groups to, like, request money, they have to go, and then, like, whatever, they close their doors, and they decide. And so we are demanding that they have open, you know, deliberations, and there's a working group to get that off the ground. And it's quite funny, because a lot of the students that are part of the, it's called Student Union at Brown University, which is FUBU, and then there's UCS, which is Undergraduate Council, Undergraduate Council Students, which is the more, like, student council.
It's the rubber stamp for administration decisions for
right.
the student body.
And it's hierarchical. They have a president, vice president. And
your classic student council.
Right. And so a lot of people in the UCS were pretty nervous about FUBU forming and upset. And they actually, after we had our, we formed the, we passed a resolution, like, more or less demanding open door policy to make the financial decisions. They quickly made a position over, like, the school listserv asking for some student to be, they made a position up called, like, student oversight task force to look over like the financial aid and the finances of the student activities people. So they essentially like saw that people were upset and they made up some like BS position.
But rather than it being accountable and open to everyone in a large participatory fashion, it was like one person.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, pretty much anti-war stuff. There have been several marches around town, and also SDS is starting to be recognized. Like, for example, United for Peace and Justice recently asked if SDS wanted to have representative on their main organizational council. I'm not sure what the status of that is. And, you know, supporting other sorts of actions in addition to doing their own autonomous stuff. And so it's an encouraging...
And then working with the community on several issues that are depend on where you are in the community. In Providence, it's like working with Olneyville Neighborhood Association and... Immigrant Defense Network, and yeah, just doing like support for community organizations.
So, I mean, okay, so outside of the colleges, in terms of problems, what are the kind of main issues that people are campaigning or struggling around?
Right now, immigration issues, immigration and the situation of immigrants, I think, are largely, what would you say, Senya?
Well, you know, for folks not really familiar with the situation, more recently, the past 2 years have seen, I think 2 years, I would imagine, have seen an increased, say, government intervention.
Well, politicians are trying to back up their tough talk about immigration with action, so there have been several raids in the greater Providence area to send undocumented people to detention camps, essentially. Yeah.
Right. And so in New Bedford, more recently, there was a big raid. About a year ago?
Something like that. New Bedford is in Massachusetts, but just across the way from...
About an hour and a half from here.
Yeah.
I think. And so folks in Providence are forming an immigrant defense network to, you know, in case of a raid, to have, you know, a community defense organization to be there to support people in our neighborhood.
To keep an eye out if such things, if there's any indication that it's coming... If, unfortunately, it has happened, be able to help out the relatives left behind. Because, like, for example, in the New Bedford situation, several women were taken, and since their children were born here, they were U.S. citizens and were left, but these children were left with no parents to take care of them and no resources. So being able to help out.
Happens to the kids who are left behind.
They stay with relatives and or friends. Unless they have, like, you know, because I know in the case of New Bedford, a lot of the women were married. Sometimes to illegal or non, you know, or legal, you know, immigrants, and they would stay with that partner. It's pretty complicated.
Okay, so the other thing is you're both involved in the IWW as well, and that's kind of interesting from, again, from that kind of moving over here and looking at it, because it seems to be something that's growing quite fast.
I was at the General Assembly this past year. Yeah, I mean, the IWW... I imagine most listeners would be aware of the fact it was pretty large in the beginning of the 20th century and then dwindled to nearly non-existence by the 1950s, and there are a few people here and there, but gained a resurgence in the 90s, especially into the early 2000s. And I think I'm a product of that to some extent. Like, for example, I joined because of the Starbucks campaign. Not because I worked at Starbucks, but because I heard about it, and that was an encouraging campaign. And I was interested in labor organizing, but was not necessarily interested in getting a job working for one of the AFL-CIO unions, and hadn't liked the history of the IWW, but was not, I didn't want to be part of something that was entirely irrelevant, but here they were dealing with the retail sector, a sector of employment that's ununionized almost exclusively in the United States, and making some gains. So I don't know the exact figures, but it has substantially grown in the past few years, and to the point where, at least in the northeast of the United States, because I haven't really gone much elsewhere, it's a regular staple of regional organizing, and you could go to even, like, for example, a mass demonstration in New York City, and you see bobby pins on people, whereas even 5 or 6 years ago, you wouldn't see them. So there's a general increase in awareness about the union, but perhaps the most encouraging campaign in this region was the foodstuff supplier organizing drive in New York, where they organized immigrant warehouse workers, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 different warehouses and made some significant gains in getting them pay raises and so forth. A bunch of them got fired, and there were actually suits to get them back wages and get them reinstated. So while it's certainly not where it needs to get, I mean, it's still very small by any standards, especially considering how large this country is, although there are some chapters in Canada and the UK and Australia, but for the most part, it's an American union, and it's getting there gradually, but I'm encouraged by the process. What do you think, Cindy?
What I think is really great about the current campaign, especially in New York, and we're originally from near the area, so we've been involved a good amount, as much as we can, considering that we live in Rhode Island currently. But one of the, I guess, one of the most encouraging things of the new about the IWW right now is that they're really focusing on, as like the original Wobblies back then are focusing on people who are essentially marginalized from American society. So they're, you know, the largely immigrant, Latino, and largely Latino workers in, the places that the large scale unions don't want to work with because they largely consider it a significant part of American economic system. And so,
yeah, it also points to the fact that a lot of the mainstream unions are not really all that interested in making large organizing drives. Like, for example, they'll donate thousands of dollars to political campaigns where they could have been putting that money into organizing and make their unions much larger. And as Senya mentioned, the IWW is dealing with immigrant workers and retail workers who are largely unorganized, and pointing to the fact that if the IWW can do it with relatively small numbers and barely any funding and no paid organizers, because there's only one paid official of the IWW, the General Secretary Treasurer, who is currently located in Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, so if it's all people that are organizing either their own workplaces or nearby workplaces and can make some success in these areas, then so could the larger unions, if only they wanted to.
Yeah, like, for example, I was talking to a member of one of the larger unions more recently on the phone. She was telling me how, essentially, the union she's a part of goes to, you know, industries where, like, they are concerned with industries that will make a difference, that, like, are big. A lot of people are a part of it because the rest don't essentially matter because they're not going to make the large impact that she wants to see. And so, like, I think it's that kind of mentality, that, like, trickle-down kind of mentality, I think. Which is like, well, if you make the big impact with, like, you know, the big jobs, the big industries that matter, then the rest will follow, which, like, problematic, and which I think the IWW is, like, trying to, is actively working to show, well, that's not the way that make change, or that one shouldn't, you know, one shouldn't forget the marginalized of society, because everyone is important, and...
And a lot of new branches have started up in areas that had not had Wobbly branches, in some cases since the 30s or the 20s or something like that. Like, we started up one in Providence where there hadn't been one for several years. There's one started in Washington, D.C. where there hadn't been one, out in Montana, in various places.
Just a final thing. You mentioned last night, I think, that your research was on a Puerto Rican anarchist feminist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Oh, sure. Well, right now I'm writing my thesis on Luisa Capetillo, who was an anarchist feminist labor organizer from Puerto Rico at the turn of the century. She was an interesting character in many ways. Well, what I'm essentially going to write about is her contradictions. So, for example, well, she wrote the first feminist treaties in Puerto Rico, which is a big deal. And she was she publicly cross-dressed in Cuba in 1915. And was arrested, and it made, you know, huge waves all over the Caribbean, you know, all along the islands and the Caribbean area, you know, in Latin America. It was just a big deal.
And what did she say in her defense?
She said that she feels comfortable, because they asked her, like, why are you wearing pants? She said...
Wasn't it something that they're much more hygienic for women and they're much more comfortable, so I decided to wear pants.
I decided to wear pants, and also, like, I'm doing it because the women have a new role in society, and... I feel comfortable and screw you, essentially. So, and she's also a single mother of three illegitimate children, which actually was not entirely uncommon at the time. It wasn't uncommon to not be married. She was a worldwide traveler. She traveled to Cuba, Dominican Republic, the States. But if you look at her writings, she talks, she has a very, what I guess the modern day readers would consider a peculiar kind of feminism. She essentially states that women need to be educated mother and loyal wives to be the backbone for a new progressive nation, which was not entirely uncommon. It was essentially first wave feminism. But what I'm trying to understand is, well, why is she, she's also an anarchist too. She has little, I think she has subtle clues about, like, well, I don't really think this, but I'm doing this because, you know, this language appeals to many people right now, and it appeals to a broad range of, it speaks essentially to the female experience at that time.
Yeah, and if she was the first person to state even a rudimentary feminism arguing that women should be regarded in their traditional roles, then
right.
She realized that she couldn't leap several steps beyond that to really challenge gender identities and so forth. So she challenged them more in her actions, but her writings were much more designed to just nudge general society forward a step.
Right, and so I'm just trying to understand the divide between her as an actor and her as a writer.
It's also informative to general studies of how to design political rhetoric to
right.
appeal to target audiences and how much to say and how much not to say. And it's an interesting example, especially in the context of feminism. Also, why don't you mention her legacy in Puerto Rico and how she's regarded there?
Right. She's in Puerto Rico, most audiences in the States don't really know much about her. I mean, she's in a couple, like, anthologies about famous Latino women. She has a pretty significant influence and history in Puerto Rico in terms of people, you know, being aware of who she is. Like, for example, in her hometown of Arecibo, Puerto Rico, she was an organization which essentially takes care of battered women and women who are victims of domestic violence and their children. That center named it after Lucy Capetillo, and it's in her hometown, as I said before.
There are just several other women's foundations and organizations named after her.
Right, and there's a lot of them. There's a research library at the University of Puerto Rico named after her, and a lot of writers, especially feminists, like young women, Latina writers. Like, for example, in this anthology called Colonize This, Young Women of Color, the New Feminism, there's this writer, I forgot her name, she mentions how growing up in Puerto Rico as a young child, Lucy Capetillo made a huge impact, like her history made a huge impact on her becoming, you know, a feminist and a radical growing up. And so there is an awareness of who she is on the island, and so what I'm trying to do is talk about, you know, if she should be part of the feminist canon, you know, and not only Puerto Rico, but in the world, and also, you know, trying to make her be remembered not only in, you know, Puerto Rico, but in the States as well.
And also be not only remembered for her feminism, but for her anarchism.
Right.
It's a little bit reminiscent of Emma Goldman, how you'll see her in anthologies and books for being a feminist. And they say, well, yeah, she was kind of crazy with this other anarchism stuff, but she was one of the, you know, important feminist voices of the time. So, you know, it's a little similar considering that Lucy Capetillo is remembered as a feminist icon, but the rest is, in many cases, not really.
Right. If you look at the historiography of Capetillo, how historians, especially in the 70s, after the Nueva Historia, which is like when, you know, largely Marxist scholars on the island, started talking about her. If you look at it, they usually describe her as a socialist, which I find kind of interesting, because we don't really talk about her politics in terms of being an anarchist, which...
She was.
She was.
Well, I think you find that in a lot of Marxist academic writings, particularly from that period, there's such an extreme sectarianism towards anarchism that, you know, people aren't, you know, the fact that people are active anarchists aren't even mentioned. I mean, the Haymarket martyrs, for instance, and a lot of European left writing about that, like modern European left, they're just presented as being socialists.
Yeah.
Zappa and Vanzetti, even.
Well, they're presented as socialists when they want to praise them or use them as an example.
Yes,
and when they
want
to vilify them, oh, well, then they're anarchists, right? So.
So I think that's kind of it's common. I think today perhaps the left is becoming a bit less sectarian, or there's not quite so much advantage in that.
We'll see. I don't know. You tell me.
In terms of Puerto Rico at the time, was she part of a? No, I don't know much Puerto Rican history. Was she part of a broader anarchist movement? Was there? You know, because in that period there would have been anarchist movements in a lot of the South American and Central American.
Oh yeah, she's so complicated.
Let's talk about the union she was part of.
Well, she's part of the FLT, which is the Federación de Trabajadores,
Workers Association.
Free Workers Association, yeah. And which was kind of, so essentially FLT was created by Samuel Gompers. With the help of...
Who was the founder of the AFL in the United States.
And so it was Gompers and the, I forgot his name, but the founder of the Socialist Party in Puerto Rico founded FLT. And then she was part of an anarchist campaign within the FLT called Campaign for Free Labor. So it's kind of interesting, like working within socialists, you know, union, but she had an anarchist campaign, and they went door to door, essentially trying to make one big union in Puerto Rico. And she worked a lot with like the sugar production was like a huge deal, and also tobacco production. So she worked with, you know, cane sugar workers and tobacco workers. She like had ties to anarchists and radical activists. Especially anarchists in Cuba and Dominican Republic. She spent time in New York City and Ybor City in Florida, which was largely Italian, German, Spanish, Cuban, American city in Florida, which was like heavily anarchist at the time. So she was like definitely part of that whole international anarchist network that was prevalent.
But not as much specifically in Puerto Rico, though, right?
Yeah.
It was sort of a tendency within the
union. It was a tendency, but it wasn't... Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like in the States, I would argue.
Right, and while I've been sitting here listening to you, I've had the idea of just wondering what I was going to do with these shows exactly. So I've had the thought that back in Ireland, people are getting bombarded with American election stories.
Oh, boy.
I've been at the States for months, so I'm thinking I might actually upload them onto Indie Media, i.e. onto the kind of The Other America...
Right.
And so I have a series of stories from activists that I travel around about.
Cool.
What else is happening? But so on that note, kind of just the elections. What do you think of the whole thing? It's a good, probably a good one to end on.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You go first.
Sure. Well, I mean, the election. Well, it's interesting because I have a lot of friends who are consider themselves anarchists and radical activists. I'm sure folks know, largely, what I'm talking about is, like, the Democrats. The Democratic Party right now, the two main candidates are Clinton and Obama, and then whatever Republicans you don't really care about because they're Republicans. But essentially, it's just this very interesting thing that's happening because a lot of, you know, my friends who call themselves anarchists and radical activists are endorsing Obama, largely, who is an African-American, the first African-American candidate.
Well, he's not the first African-American to run for Democratic nomination. Okay. If he gets the nomination, he'll be the first to get the nomination.
Right, which is a pretty big deal.
And Clinton would be the first woman to get the nomination of either party.
And so, you know, Mark and I have had plenty of conversations about this. And so I think it's pretty fascinating. And I think it shows, it sort of, still, as you said, like, it solidifies the more or less gains that the 60s had, at least in terms of national politics. And, like, I think it's important to understand, well, I don't support Obama. I'm not going to vote for him. I don't vote, generally. I'm not going to go canvass for him either. Clinton, I can't stand Clinton. But I think it's important to understand where that kind of momentum and that energy and that passion for Obama is coming from, especially among, like, young progressive youth. And I don't think it's really quite, can't find the word right now, but I don't think it's really good for people to sort of write it off as just like, you know, another election, because, you know, historically in terms of American, especially race relations, I think this is a pretty, like, I think it's incredibly important to be aware of it and be like, you know, this is important and it means something to people. But essentially, you know, at the end of the day, if you look at Obama's, like, stance or politics, like, he's not he's not at all, like, progressive or...
Well, I'd say he's on the left end of the Democratic Party spectrum, which...
But I mean, in terms of, like, my friends who, like, call themselves anarchists, like, who are Palestine solidarity activists, who are supporting a candidate who's, like, really, really Zionist, and, like...
Right, well...
Like that, for example, like...
It's gone beyond the lesser of two evils argument.
Right.
Like, for example, when Kerry ran against Bush in the 2004 election, plenty of people voted for Kerry just because they hated Bush. It was the not-Bush vote. And this time, there are plenty of people who are legitimately excited about Obama in a way that I haven't seen in my short experience observing campaigns. And they're willing to overlook a lot of things, such as the fact that Obama, as you mentioned, supports Israel. If you're a Palestine solidarity activist, presumably you would be against that. Civil liberties issues, like Obama said he would support a law prosecuting flag burners, for example, which for a progressive seems like a clear-cut thing that you wouldn't throw someone in jail or prosecute them for burning a piece of cloth, regardless of what's on it. And other sorts of things. He said that he would consider invading Pakistan if he thought that there was Al-Qaeda there.
Free trade agreement.
Well, the economic stuff, of course, he's just a generic Democrat. But people, even a lot of these people, I would imagine, would concede these points. But there's sort of a romanticism and an emotion tied to him. He invokes a lot of the rhetoric of the civil rights movement in the United States in the 60s. And just the fact that he is an African-American speaks for a lot of people. And perhaps, to look at it optimistically, if he were to win, perhaps it would have an important step in making Americans understand that understanding that African-American could have an important leadership role.
Right.
And on the other side, if Clinton were to win, understand that women can have important leadership roles. I mean, even the fact that, like, while I'm not a fan of electoral politics, the fact that, for example, women got the right to vote, that there's more of a common understanding that women can be equal to men before the eyes of the law, you know, it's an important step. There's, like, less for anarchists to convince people of, perhaps you might say. But when it comes down to it, I still think that McCain's going to win the election against either of them personally. Senya disagrees. Well, we'll see.
I think someone can listen
to this interview after November and hear who's right. But, I mean, there's a lot of little subtle cues that I think will turn people off to Obama. For example, the obvious fact that Barack Obama sounds to a lot of people that are not very well educated, like Osama bin Laden. I've heard the mistake made innocently.
One of my friend's professors made that mistake in her class.
Right.
Can you believe that? Like, and that's not like a woman with a freaking PhD from, like, Harvard, like, saying, oh, Osama bin Laden, oh, wait, I meant Barack Obama. And she considers herself Democrat, she didn't vote for Obama, but, like, that kind of seeping into your mind like that is, like,
that's
whoa.
Similarity in name has become something of a mind, you know, where kind of, because I actually only realize now, I've heard people reference it,
yeah.
not explain it, and only realize now what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that similar, actually. It's kind of vaguely similar.
It kind of, but beyond being similar, it sounds unlike names that most Americans have ever heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it doesn't sound white. And so, I think that sort of thing, and just the fact that there is a deep-seated racism in the country, will work against him, and I think people will fall back on their prejudices. And in addition, if somehow Hillary Clinton rallies, who, incidentally, in case any listeners don't know, is the wife of former President Bill Clinton, who served 8 years.
I know that.
Just letting people know, you know, you never know. And a lot of people just have a visceral dislike and hatred of Bill Clinton and associate Hillary with all that stuff, and I think there's a lot of baggage in terms of that. And in terms of McCain, he's viewed as being rather honest and trustworthy. He was a Vietnam veteran who served a long time as a prisoner of war in a Vietnamese prison camp. And so he, I think, comes across as someone who has actually lived the experience of the military, whereas, like, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton before him didn't serve. Bush got out of Vietnam by being in the Texas National Guard.
The Army got on that surface level.
Yeah.
One of the obvious advantages McCain has is that he's everything Bush isn't. Like, the kind of things that annoyed people about Bush, he isn't, so...
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, all three candidates actually have sort of struck an in-between position on the Iraq War, for example. They've said, well, you know, maybe it was all right to go into Iraq, but it was handled poorly. Barack Obama, when right before he ran for Senate, was anti-war, like, explicitly, but he's actually modified his statements to the point where he says that really the main problem was how it was handled. Hillary Clinton voted for the war. McCain, by virtue of being a Republican, couldn't really explicitly say the war was a bad idea. But so, as far as the Iraq War, ironically, there's not much of a difference, but McCain is perceived as having more actual experience, expertise, knowledge. And, you know, I think that a lot of people still have a lot of prejudices that, unfortunately, they won't be over anytime soon, but perhaps I'll be proven wrong.
Yeah, well, one interesting thing I heard, and this is on Canadian radio, was that in the Republican primaries, the exit polls indicated that anti-war Republicans were overwhelmingly voting for McCain, despite the fact that he doesn't have an anti-war stance.
Yeah.
But on the premise that they felt he could be trusted to, if things go badly again, really they mean badly for the U.S. Army rather than the Iraqis, that he would then pull the army out.
Yeah, anti-war means something different to different people. For some people it means anti-war, and for other people it means war done well where we, like, win and don't lose a lot of our own soldiers. And so, you know, and then the other consideration, which is somewhat of a legitimate consideration, that, well, the United States does now have a presence in Iraq, so what is to be done about that? A lot of Democrats who voted all the Democratic Congress people into office in the last congressional election did it with the intention that once the Democrats controlled the Congress, they could use their legislative power to withdraw funding for the war, and it would all just stop and they would bring it home. And surprise, surprise, that didn't happen. Most people in the Congress have a gradual withdrawal plan.